Hi.
Hi, welcome to Tour Guide Tell All, your friendly neighborhood tour guides.
Yes, who want to talk about all things drug, alcohol, and scandal related. I'm Rebecca.
I'm Becca. And yes, today our topic is presidential drinking. I should say we chose this topic just because we've had some heavy content on the podcast the last couple of months. We've been talking about politics and about all kinds of really intense, heavy things. And let's be honest, it's summer. It is so hot in DC. In fact, we are in the midst of breaking a heat wave streak right now.
If it hits 90 today, it's like, what, the 20th day?
Yeah, 20 days of 90 degree heat, which, guys, is very hot.
It really is.
So we have decided to crack open some cold ones and talk about presidents and their imbibing. And we invite you to imbibe along with us. Rebecca, what are you drinking today?
Actually, I am drinking from a local brewery. I live, because DC is a wonderful and magical place, I live literally a block away from a brewery. It's called Red Bear, and they are fantastic. They have this great big warehouse, and they're LGBTQ friendly, and they have really excellent beers, and I love to give them a shout out. Red Beer Brewing. I am drinking their DC Dirt Porter, which is not really summer drinking. Porters are usually a little heavy, but as we'll talk about, several of our early presidents really enjoyed the porter. So that's where I'm at. What are you drinking, Becca?
I cannot drink a porter in the summer, even though I'm sitting in my very cool apartment. I am drinking local to me. I'm going to show it to you on the screen. This is from Chubby Squirrel. I live in Fairfax, and this is my favorite microbrew that's really just, gosh, about a year and a half old. It's still pretty young. They're right in downtown Fairfax. They're amazing. Hi, Boyd, if you're listening. I'm a huge fan. Chubby Squirrel Brewing Company, we're coming to the 2-year anniversary. But I'm drinking a Hazy Squirrel. This is the New England style IPA. It's very crisp, very hoppy, which is what I like in the summer. But I love them because during the COVID times, they switch all their operations to do like kind of curbside pickup and delivery, which was so amazing and helpful. And they brewed a lot of great beers, including an FUCOVID beer, which was very tasty. So I decided to rep my Chubby Squirrel today, which is kind of my go-to out here. But I have to say, for those listening, DC and its surrounding area is pretty great if you like to drink. Not only are there amazing breweries, but you head out into Virginia, not very far from DC, and you're at great vineyards and distilleries, and there's just so much, I think, within an hour or two of the city if you like to imbibe. And right now, that's kind of been how I've enjoyed some weekends, is being outdoors, distanced at the vineyard, because what else are you gonna do?
Yeah, super, super cosign. Yeah, there's a lot of great beer and wine, and it's very, yes, very exciting.
So we share our love of drinking with many people who have occupied the highest office in the land. Of course, there's a few caveats.
That was a good segue. I liked it.
A few caveats to what we're going to discuss today, Rebecca.
The one big caveat, as with most of our, I think all of our pods, we don't like to talk about anyone who still lives. So we're going to talk about presidents who have shuffled off the mortal coil. And so we're gonna do the non-living ones.
And I think maybe just as a little bit of a blanket statement, especially when we're talking about our 18th and 19th century presidents, it's important to keep in mind when we're talking about the drinking, the amount of drinking, that this is a time period where often spirits were the safest thing to drink. So we have to remember that water was what caused most illness and death. So when you're hearing some of these things, it's going to sound as though people were absolutely in their cups all the time. But we have to remember that often that was just what they drank in small amounts in lieu of water, because water would kill you. So please keep that in mind as you listen. I don't want to give off the impression that every one of these presidents was drunk all the time. Somewhere.
And it also is worth mentioning that we tend to have, when we think about beer in the United States today, we think about 5-7% alcohol. Back then, we're talking about 3% alcohol. So it's much less, like if you're having 4 or 5 beers, you're having much less, particularly if you're George Washington, who's 6'3" and a pretty substantial guy. You're talking about a lot less alcohol that's running through.
They brought that weak British beer style with them.
They really did.
Well, you mentioned George. I guess we should start with the first, the OG, the founding father, George Washington. George Washington, I have to say, is not a man who was known for getting drunk or intoxicated. This was a man who really was obsessed with appearance and civility. I mean, he writes out those rules of civility, even as a young man, right? He holds himself to this very high standard. He has very little patience for people who can't drink in moderation. But with that said, Washington was a drinker. It was very much part of the culture. And if you wanted to be a gentleman farmer, if you wanted to be involved in politics and grow in your political realm, you had to be comfortable with drinking. That's where business took place. It took place in taverns and over these dinners. Eating was not comfortable for Washington because of the dentures, which I believe we talked about in our DC Myths episode. But drinking was something he could do comfortably in the company of other people and not feel self-conscious about. Like a lot of people in this generation, this kind of first generation in the United States from England, he favored Madeira and port, which were kind of the popular fortified wines. He would drink rum punch, which was pretty common, and then whiskey. He liked the only beer that we really know that he drank was a porter, which was pretty popular back then, but he isn't a big beer drinker. It's usually Madeira, port, or whiskey. What Washington really saw with alcohol wasn't so much what he could get out of it in terms of liquidation, but what he could get out of it financially. Washington is exceptionally savvy about the business side of distilling, particularly. Washington has an estate that he inherits from his half-brother, Mount Vernon. Mount Vernon is sizable. The part of it that exists today is just a sliver of the amount of land Washington owned in his lifetime. And on that land, he builds a gristmill and a distillery. He is not alone. In the 1810 census of Virginia, there were 3,600 distilleries. Just in Virginia. That is insane to me. We have 100 counties in Virginia. So you literally had distilleries on every piece of property. Everybody distilled. And again, you had to because it's what you drank with meals. It was safer than water and you could sell it. And it was a financial property. Washington really invested in his distillery at Mount Vernon. He had a distiller that he really trusted, James Anderson, and they grew that business. It was one of the most profitable pieces of Mount Vernon. There were some years where distilling was the number one source of income, but it usually ranked right up there in the top three. In his last year of life, 1799, 11,000 gallons of spirits were distilled at Mount Vernon. It really fed his wealth, and it was a huge business opportunity for him. So at the time of his death in 1799, he was one of the largest distillers of whiskey in the United States, and I don't think a lot of people know that about Washington and his business.
I think people understand that he might have, like, brewed beer or had whiskey, but the extent of it and, like, how big it is in his land holdings. I would also like to give a shout out. Washington was a big beer drinker, and as was Jefferson and Ben Franklin, and there is a brewery out of Philadelphia today, Victory, that is brewing beers of the revolution, which I highly recommend if you find them somewhere. Sometimes you can find them at Mount Vernon, and I can never buy them because I'm always at Mount Vernon with a school group, and they tend to frown on the chaperones and tour guides purchasing alcohol for understandable reasons. But the Tavern Porter is George Washington's beer, and it's brewed with molasses, and it's really, really, really excellent. So I would highly recommend that. Moving right along in order, we're going to do this kind of orderly. John Adams started every day, pretty much, of his adult life with a tankard of hard cider.
It's a little morning pick-me-up.
He also drank porter, New England porter, kind of good for those cold New England winters. He drank rum, and people of all classes in those days liked their food and their drink sweet. And so you're going to see a lot of people drink Madeira. Madeira is a fortified wine from Portugal, and it's exceedingly popular up and down the colonies. It's sort of fallen out of favor more or less today, but Washington drinks it, Franklin drinks it, Adams and Jefferson drink it. Madeira is hugely.
There's also the economic side of that, which they could get it imported. They could get it there. There was no trade barrier even during the revolution. They could get Madeira in and they could get it at a reasonable tax and tariff. So you drank what you could get.
Kind of, yeah.
And could afford.
Moving on to Jefferson.
Yeah, I didn't mean to segue into Jefferson, but hoo boy. So Thomas Jefferson. It's hard for me right now. I'm still in the rewatching Hamilton on Disney Plus phase of my summer. So I just, when I think of Jefferson, it's Daveed Diggs in my head right now. Jefferson is not particularly a big drinker, as it were, as a young man. He drinks Madeira and port and porter and these things that are common. But it isn't until he gets his taste of French wine that his life has changed forever.
Same. Same, really.
I like to imagine Jefferson like sipping a French wine and the angels chorus begins and the clouds part. And we now will understand why Jefferson dies in debt, because yes, he has gotten the taste for the good stuff. And that is what he wants. Jefferson said, "In nothing have the habits of the palate more decisive influence than in our relish of wines," mm-hmm, which is pretty amazing. He is going to be minister to France, which will be very convenient. So he's gotten this taste of French wine, and then he gets to go to France, and he gets there. Now, this is a really important time in American history. He has a lot of things to do. And Rebecca, do you know what he does when he first gets to France?
Obviously does important ministerial things.
Oh, no. He does a 3-month wine tasting tour. So he travels around the wine region, which is what I would do, tasting wines and, I don't know, and, you know, ministering perhaps a little. But he basically just does a wine tour. He studies these wines. He makes connections with these vineyards. And when he comes back to the United States, he becomes one of the first people in this new country, period, to import French wine. And what he's doing is unique because he's not going through middlemen, through vendors, through salesmen. He's buying directly from the vineyard. Nobody was doing that back then, and having it shipped straight to him. And there was a reason he did that, was that a lot of these companies that would ship wine back and forth, they were slightly better than pirates. They would gather wine from multiple vineyards to fill these orders. And, you know, you've got a long transatlantic journey. You're going to dip into the wine. You're going to dip into it, and then just water it down. And that's what happened for a lot of these people who were buying wine. And Jefferson was not about that life. So he did direct. He worked with specific shipping companies to ensure that the quality of the wine would be consistent. He's one of the first people in this country to use wine as an investment. He buys bottles specifically to save and age himself. They estimate at Monticello today that he probably went through 400 bottles a year living at Monticello. His typical day was to have a glass of wine with every meal. So a glass of wine with breakfast, a glass of wine with lunch, and then for dinner you would have a glass of wine with every course. So again, they're not drinking the Olivia Pope scandal giant wine glasses, right, where you have like the whole bottle in there. They're drinking 3 ounces, 4 ounces at a time, but it's still a pretty big amount of wine. And he brings that love of wine to the White House. He becomes president of the United States, and he's looking around the White House. You know, John Adams had lived there. There was no wine cellar. He's like, this will not do. So in his very first term as president, he spent the equivalent today of about $120,000 on wine. Later on, they tabulated that he spent $42,000 just on Madeira as president of the United States. So he's spending big, big money. I have to laugh, though, because in researching this episode and looking at some of Jefferson's writings on wine, there's a letter or a diary that John Quincy Adams kept of his interactions with some of these notable people. And John Quincy Adams dined with Jefferson at the White House in the early 1800s. And he wrote, "There was, as usual, a dissertation upon wines, not very edifying." So apparently Jefferson was a bit of a wine snob and might have been a bit of a wine bore.
Yes. Jefferson, it should be noted, he did not, as in many things in his life, Jefferson didn't spare himself. He drank the good stuff. Some names, if you're interested in French wine today, you'd recognize Haut-Brion, Chateau Latour, like first growth, really good shit. And he also is going to bring vines back to the United States and try to grow them here. So the sort of side plot about Thomas Jefferson is whatever else he did or didn't do with regard to the Declaration and being president and all that, Jefferson is almost single-handedly responsible for the entire modern American wine industry.
And it is important to note that Jefferson does die pretty deeply in debt. Estimates today put it about $100,000 in debt. And a big chunk of that is he spends extravagantly on the importing of this wine. And it's not cheap because he is paying for the shipping. He's investing. He's buying not just the run-of-the-mill stuff. He's buying high-quality wines. And that does catch up with him financially as he falls into debt.
Oh, yeah.
Now I'm wishing we had wine to go with this beer.
Now I'm wishing we had wine, yes. James Madison, fourth president. James Madison was a devotee of champagne. He wrote that champagne is the most delightful wine when drank in moderation, but that more than a few glasses always produced a headache the next day. So apparently James Madison is the first president to discover hangovers. Probably not really. But he used to drink champagne. He drank, in fact, champers at a local tavern called Gatsby's, which is still here. It's in Old Town Alexandria. And that's where he went to celebrate his inauguration as President of the United States. So a champagne toast.
I share Madison's love of champagne, and I do not find that it will give me a headache the next day. I included a quote about champagne in my wedding vows, so that's how much I love champagne. Moving along from James Madison, I'm going to talk about a president that when I talk about him on the drinking part of my tour, people are like, who? What? But I have to mention Martin Van Buren. Now, if you're listening to this podcast and you're like, Martin Van Buren, not much to say about him as president. He'll become Jackson's second vice president. But he had one of the all-time great presidential nicknames. His nickname was Blue Whiskey Van, which just sounds like a band from the 70s to me. And next up is Blue Whiskey Van. Blue Whiskey Van for Martin Van Buren, because apparently he could drink whiskey till he was blue in the face. He was known for being a hard drinker. This is the guy who would go drink to drink, toe to toe with you with whiskey, and he would get intoxicated. I like this too, because when you think about Blue Whiskey Van, I want you to think about this Davy Crockett quote. Davy Crockett once described Van Buren's appearance. He is what the English call a dandy, laced up in corsets such as a woman in town wear, and if possible, tighter than the best of them. It would be difficult to say from his personal appearance whether he is a man or woman, but for his large whiskers. So, you know, he was a bit of a dandy. He was very sought after for parties because he was very funny and charming and courteous. But when it came to drinking, it was whiskey all day, every day. And he was known to get a little out of control. It's not too surprising that he eventually gets gout, which is also something that Ben Franklin will deal with. And certainly the constant imbibing doesn't help if you're trying to avoid gout.
So, gonna do a couple of presidents real rapid fire here for you. Andrew Jackson was a whiskey drinker. Presumably that led to several of his duels. We'll see. William Henry Harrison, our shortest tenured president. He was considered too old to be president. He was 68 years old when he ran, and so his opponents charged that they should just give him a barrel of hard cider, $2,000 pension for life, and he will sit the remainder of his days in a log cabin. And so William Henry Harrison very smartly turned that into a campaign slogan. He ran what was called the Hard Cider and Log Cabin Campaign. It portrayed him as the common man, sort of a man of the people. He could drink, and the Americans have long had a fascination with having a president we could have a beer with. So this is going to come from William Henry Harrison, and he wins and then dies of pneumonia 31 days later. Wah, wah. Zachary Taylor, he was a general. Upon being informed that the Whig Party wanted him to nominate him for president, he said to the man telling him this, "Stop your nonsense and drink your whiskey," which is a man after my own heart. But Franklin Pierce, not a president we hear a whole lot about. Poor Franklin Pierce.
I have to jump in, probably because I've had a little bit of this beer already. And I just want to say, I call him Franklin Pierce secretly fierce, because if you look at pictures of young Franklin Pierce, I got to say, ladies, I think at a coffee shop reading his poetry, like, I'd be into it.
Yeah, I could see it.
He's got that look. Dark and mysterious.
Please pause and look for a picture of young Franklin Pierce.
We'll add it to our show notes.
Yeah. Yep. He was good looking in his younger days. Franklin Pierce is considered the drunkest president in American history. Now, I don't honestly know what the criteria and how they measure that, but
I think the saddest of our drinking presidents.
He was. Franklin Pierce drank a lot of everything. And part of it is because he had a really rough personal life. Him and his wife had three sons, two of whom died in babyhood, and the third one dies right after his father gets elected president. So they're heading on a train to Washington. His son Benjamin is 11 years old and gets killed in a freak train accident. So he's on his way to being president. His son has just been killed, and his wife, Jane, at this point, just checks out. She can't, she doesn't want her husband to be president anyway. And now she sees this as sort of God, like speaking about her husband being president, and she completely checks out. And he deals with this by drinking basically everything that can be put in front of him. He is arrested while president for drunk carriage driving. And when the policeman, yes, apparently you can drunkenly drive a carriage and run into people similar to a car. And when the policemen figure out who it is, they sort of quietly like say, oh, okay, pal, like, why don't you just go back to the White House? It was formerly in the military, so he's known throughout Washington as the hero of many a well-fought battle while he's president. So yeah. And then when he's done being president, he gets voted out of office and he says, well, what is a former president to do except get drunk? Which is what he proceeds to do until he dies of cirrhosis of the liver about a decade or so later in 1869. So Franklin Pierce, hero of many a well-fought battle.
It's a little bit more a tragic drinking story, I feel. I know we had said we'd try to keep it light, but I share the Pierce story on our White House at Night tour where we talk about scandals, and I do a little bit on, I know you do too, on presidential drinking. But a lot of people don't realize that about Pierce, that he suffered this tragic loss. His wife is considered the first lady to hold a séance in the White House. This is actually prior to Mary Todd Lincoln because of the death of her son and the tragedy there. And so she is very much checked out from being first lady, very much grieving her son. And he just falls into that well of grief, into a bottle, and it is sad. I guess we'll lighten it up ever so slightly with a man named James Buchanan. If you've listened to our mini episode on the Buchanan Memorial, you know that Buchanan, not well regarded as president of the United States, he often tops the list of some of the worst presidents, but it's not because of his drinking, it's because of his politics. I'm going to talk about his drinking because I think, and we can decide at the end of this episode, who we think the biggest party boy was, but I think it might be old James Buchanan. Buchanan, and if you guys have to Google these people and look at their pictures while we're talking, because if you look at him, he does not look like a fun guy. He does not look like somebody who could cut loose and have a good time. But he was in college like a hardcore frat boy. He's almost expelled twice from Dickinson College due to his behavior while intoxicated, which imagine in this era how drunk you have to be expelled from college in the 1800s for drinking. He somehow manages to get it together, get graduated, start a law practice, get into politics. According to a local liquor merchant named Jacob Bear, Buchanan would buy a 10-gallon bottle, keg of whiskey every week and drank it. To put this into mathematical terms, if you imagine that a typical shot's like 1.5 ounces, a 10-gallon thing of whiskey is 860 shots of whiskey a week. 860 shots of whiskey. Now, I'm sure a lot of that was for entertaining as well. You'd have people come over and enjoy that with you, but he had to be putting away, estimates are at least a tenth of that tub of whiskey. I don't even know what you would call a 10-gallon barrel, that he was probably drinking a gallon of it himself a week, which is just insane to me. He did also really enjoy Madeira and port, but he also got a little tetchy about his drinking. He once had to chastise a merchant for bringing champagne, but only bringing it in pints as opposed to magnums, which is what he had ordered. And so it wasn't enough champagne for him. He would write in letters that he thought Russian nobility were lightweights, but that the Russian kind of common folk he met in his travels were the best kind of drinking buddies. So when he was Secretary of State and abroad, he liked to drink with the Russian commoners, but found that their nobility was too refined.
And have you ever had vodka? Like, that's they drink.
They party in Russia. So I'm thinking about some of the Russian figures from this time. If we think about Alexander Badisco, he didn't, yep. He would have thought that he couldn't really drink and he preferred the commoner. There was a journalist, though, who was working in Washington, D.C., William Forney, during Buchanan's presidency, and he wrote this. The Madeira and sherry he has consumed would fill more than one cellar, and the rye whiskey that he punished would make Jacob Bear's heart glad. More than one ambitious tyro who sought to follow his example gathered an early fall. So nobody could keep up with him. And here's the incredible thing. Allegedly, Buchanan never got hangovers. There is no evidence. If you look at what journalists wrote, people who knew him served in his cabinet, he would get up. He'd be focused, clear-headed the next day. It did not impact his ability to be the worst president or one of the worst presidents that we've ever had.
That is just not fair.
It's not right to drink like that. I mean, that kind of insanity. But yeah, Buchanan, yeah, a real party boy president. This is what he was focusing on instead of trying to prevent the Civil War.
Wow. I mean, I knew he drank. I didn't realize it was like quite such copious amounts of.
Yeah, so much.
Whew, boy.
I will lean into the man who followed Buchanan in the White House, somebody I much prefer, and that's President Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln is not really a drinker. He pretty much abstains from drinking, smoking, and chewing tobacco. So it puts him in kind of this rare category of presidents who abstain pretty much entirely in their life. Lincoln did run a general store, though, and the store did sell whiskey, which one time kind of got him in trouble with some political opponents who claimed that basically it was a grocery, which back then was synonymous with saloon. So they tried to paint Lincoln as running this sort of seedy grocery when really he was just running a general store that, of course, would sell whiskey because back then everybody drank it. But I think it's pretty much unlikely that he was imbibing in any of what he was selling.
Yeah, no, he doesn't seem like a big drinker. The guy who follows him, however, is Andrew Johnson. Is, well, first, obviously, he's Lincoln's vice president. And it should be mentioned about Andrew Johnson, Andrew Johnson never really felt that he had a big chip on his shoulder. And I think part of the drinking was to sort of compensate for that, to sort of help ease him into social situations. And before he becomes president, when he gets sworn in at Lincoln's second inaugural, Andrew Johnson manages to make a fool of himself from the very first day on the national stage. He shows up to his inauguration as Vice President of the United States, wasted, completely intoxicated. And it's like noon, okay? Presidents are sworn in the middle of the afternoon. Lincoln gives this beautiful address. Everybody's read the second inaugural. And then the whole party goes into the Capitol for sort of a luncheon. And it's traditional at that point, the vice president gets sworn in as well. And the vice president's going to give a speech. And Andrew Johnson, he gets up and he gives this speech. And it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Because like I mentioned, he's drunk. And you can imagine, like, this is all of political Washington, all the who's and what's and the powers that be. And they're all sitting at this luncheon, including Lincoln, by the way. And they're just staring as Andrew Johnson just rattles on about who knows what forever, it seems like. And, you know, you've all been at a party.
This is uncomfortable.
It's very uncomfortable. Everybody's mortified. And he's just babbling on and on. And eventually somebody has to go up to him and escort him off the stage. Like, yeah, buddy. Okay. It's time to sit down now. Yep. Mm-hmm, you're good. And like literally lead him to his seat because he's so intoxicated that he doesn't know what's going on. And even Lincoln himself says, whoa, keep that guy away from me. And so Lincoln puts his distance between him and Andrew Johnson, because again, Andrew Johnson has just made a fool of himself on the national stage. Now, in the days that come, two things happen. First of all, Johnson will tell everybody, you know, he had been sick and his doctors had prescribed whiskey in order to help with the
medicinal.
Yeah, medicinal whiskey, which is completely fabricated, but it gives him at least some cover of respectability. Lincoln will also try to defend Andrew Johnson. He's known Johnson for a long time and it wasn't so bad, but this is not a very auspicious start to his residence on the national stage. Now, Johnson basically hides out for the 5 weeks in between his inauguration as vice president and Lincoln's assassination. And when he's informed the night that Lincoln has been shot that he's about to be president of the United States, I mean, in fairness to Andrew Johnson, this is not great news. Obviously, bad things are happening and there's no good way to respond to this kind of information. Someone's dying, the country's in chaos. But Andrew Johnson hears that he's about to be president of the United States and falls apart. He basically goes on a 3 week long panic attack slash bender and falls deep into a bottle and has to crawl his way out. He's not a lot is heard from him the first 3 weeks he's president of the United States. He's sort of reluctant to move into the White House. Lincoln's funeral is sort of headed up by someone else. The investigation into Lincoln's death is led by somebody else. So Johnson's sort of MIA, having a bender for like 3 weeks. And it takes him 3 weeks to realize wait a second, it's not a nightmare. I really am the president of the United States, and to proceed from there. And Johnson just does not, I mean, whiskey seems to have been his drink of choice. He doesn't sort of slow down with the drinking from there. If you listen to our Garfield and Gateau episode, James Garfield, who's in the House of Representatives at that time, makes a comment about how he thought Andrew Johnson was drunk on opium and whiskey. So there's a lot of speculation that Johnson doesn't really quit the bottle while he's in the White House. The next president I want to move on and mention is Ulysses S. Grant.
We can't talk about presidents and drinking, not talking about Grant, because I think that's the president I can ask the most about related to alcohol.
Yes. Lincoln has a great quote about Grant. So there are rumors during the Civil War that Grant is drinking during the war. And there's nothing to substantiate this. But Lincoln says, if Grant is an alcoholic, get me 6 or 7 more like him, because he fights. And there's a lot of popular sort of his enemies will use this throughout his public career that Grant is a drunk. Grant is drinking on the job. There's really not a lot of hard evidence about any of this. It is pretty clear that Grant had some kind of problem with alcohol. He seems to have had an abnormally low tolerance. So he got drunk pretty quickly. One or two drinks made him quote, stupid. But he goes through long periods of abstinence as well. So he doesn't drink while he's in command of the Union forces. He doesn't drink in the White House. His main biographer, the most recent biographer, Ron Chernow, writes that Grant was probably a functional alcoholic, but a lot of his drinking seems to coalesce around long periods of boredom. So he drinks when he's in California, away from his family and his wife. He drinks sort of when he's bored and when his wife is away from him. So whether it's something to do with the absence of his wife, we don't know. But he really seems to have been able to leave it whenever he needed to.
From some of what I've read, too, it seems that it isn't always with Grant that he drank such copious amounts, but that he didn't have the stamina that, you know, we're talking about some of these guys like Buchanan who are putting it away, or Blue Whiskey Van Buren. But it just seems like with Grant, he couldn't drink to that level. It did get to him.
Yes. And it also seems that he knew that he couldn't drink much, so he didn't. His vice was cigar smoking. He was a big cigar smoker. And he seems like he knew enough to sort of avoid alcohol when he needed to. So the charges of Grant being a drunk are a little bit overblown, I think. It also should be mentioned he was enormously popular while he was president, and it's only sort of after his death that his reputation takes a nosedive. But throughout his public career, his opponents are going to continue to charge him with being a drunk, and there's not as much evidence for it.
Oh, over to me. So you were talking about Grant and cigar smoking being his vice. And I was just thinking to myself, our next guy is going to have that vice and the alcohol vice as well. Grover Cleveland. Grover Cleveland, one of the most unhealthy people to be president of the United States. As you know, I'm a Taft truther, and I feel bad that so often when we talk about William Howard Taft, we talk about his weight, but Grover Cleveland is a big guy. He's a big guy. He likes chomping on those cigars. He smokes copiously, and he is a big drinker. I think the best story to sort of sum up Grover Cleveland and his drinking is that early in his political career, when he was running for district attorney, he basically made a pact with one of his buddies that they would not have more than 4 beers a day on the campaign trail. Because, you know, you're out, you're hobnobbing, everybody wants to have a beer with you, right? I'd like to have a beer with him. So he said, okay, we can only have 4 beers a day, which I guess is a reasonable rule. But pretty quickly, Grover Cleveland's like, this isn't cutting it. No. It can't be 4 beers. They amended it to, we can't have 4 tankers of beer a day. So they went from like a little pint glass to, okay, a tankard. So, you know, a good half a gallon. I don't know how the measurements were, but basically based on how beer was measured back then, and the fact that Cleveland was campaigning in the Midwest, which had a lot of German culture, we have to imagine they were going to beer gardens and beer halls. So we're probably saying that they meant full liter steins when they said no more than 4 beers a day. So he was probably drinking 4 liters of beer daily on the campaign trail. He definitely keeps that up in the White House. Big amounts of beer, cider, and wine. And if you look at some photos of Cleveland, you can see he carried it for sure. Now, kind of the polar opposite of that is going to be the Hayes administration. Coming along is Rutherford B. Hayes and his wife, Lucy, who has been given the moniker of Lemonade Lucy, although that doesn't come in her lifetime. That's sort of picked up later on. But they become the first couple to really have the outright ban on alcohol in the White House. And I think sometimes in the way that we talk about these things, that little bit of sexism gets in, where she's painted as this very stern, harsh wife who bans alcohol from the White House because she doesn't want anyone to have any fun. And it's much more complicated than that. Lucy Hayes, like a lot of women of her generation, was part of the temperance movement. She was very well educated. She had seen in her life growing up the ill effect that alcohol had on families, on the abuse that came from overindulgence in alcohol. She saw families where their entire livelihood was lost on alcohol. So she saw real societal woes that came from overdrinking. And the temperance movement, which had a lot of educated women, a lot of overlap with the suffrage movement at this time, was a big influence on Lucy. Now, when they first moved into the White House, they didn't have a ban on alcohol. They actually hosted a big state dinner and the alcohol flowed very freely. They were hosting Grand Duke Alexis of Russia, but because they served the alcohol, there was actually all this press attention, and were they hypocrites, and why was Lucy part of the temperance movement and serving, and it became such a spotlight on them, and it made her so uncomfortable that actually her husband, President Rutherford B. Hayes, decided to implement the ban. So I think in history now we sort of say, oh, that stern old woman, she wouldn't let him drink, but it was Hayes who said, this is just better if we don't. And I mean, she did speak about her sons having never tasted liquor and they would never receive it from her hand. And she really supported that. But I think we've talked about this a little bit before, that when you decide to stop serving alcohol in Washington, D.C., this is a problem. So much of diplomacy and politics
is conducted around liquor and wine, and it's polite.
Yes, and very much so when it comes to entertaining ambassadors and foreign ministers. And, you know, it's the lubricant upon which most work gets done in Washington.
And it's part of the ritual of diplomacy. Diplomacy is very ritualistic. There's a lot of, you know, planning that goes into it. And to show up, and it's an insult to somebody who's an ambassador to coming and saying, no, I'm sorry, we don't have any liquor for you. You have to drink iced tea or whatever.
So you can imagine there's quite a bit of coverage of this. One newspaper described Mrs. Hayes' success in her temperance crusade among the diplomatic corps, whose members she compelled to astonish their stomachs with cold water for the first time in their lives. So some of these people did have to adapt. Shout out, though, to a White House steward. There was a steward who concocted something he called Roman punch, which was egg whites, sugar, lemon juice, and rum. And he was known to slip it into people's glasses before the first lady arrived to dine, or he would freeze it and he put it into cubes that he put into oranges, which they served as part of the dessert. There was also a political opponent of Hayes who did something kind of mean-spirited, sent a rum-soaked cake to the White House, which they then unknowingly served to guests, and then wrote an editorial basically calling them hypocrites for accepting this cake that they didn't know was soaked in rum. So it was a controversial step. It's very unusual. If you look, obviously, we're talking about so many presidents now who certainly love drinking and enjoyed having drinking as part of the White House culture. But I think it's important to remember that the temperance movement was a major movement in the United States. It certainly attracted a lot of women, and the ill effects of drinking often fell to women who at this time in America's history have very few rights. They have no way out of an abusive marriage. They have no recourse if a husband spends everything that he makes on alcohol. And so the temperance movement had a lot of momentum in this period. So it's not unusual to me to have a president that might reflect what was happening socially in a lot of parts of the United States. But it definitely makes him unique in this podcast episode for not really. He was not an abstainer himself, but he didn't have a problem with not drinking.
Yeah, I've heard that he would kind of drink behind her back.
Yeah, but he was not a heavy drinker. He was not a copious drinker, but that he himself would imbibe and he would drink. But they were not going to serve it to people at the White House. And that was his call. It was not Lemonade Lucy.
That's fair. Okay. Teddy Roosevelt apparently loved a good mint julep. Did you know that, Becca?
I did not, but I love it.
I know. Isn't that so great? Taft, also not a particularly big drinker. I know you're a Taft truther. He drank socially, I think, but not really.
Not to intoxicating levels.
Nope. But the next president, and I am well, just as Becca loves Lincoln, I am well known for hating Woodrow Wilson.
with good reason.
Good reason. However, there is one thing about Wilson I feel that we can all get behind in a big way. Woodrow Wilson was a big drinker. Southern Democrat. He loved the whiskey. He had a scotch and soda quite frequently. But he also had and was very knowledgeable about a very nice wine collection. Woodrow Wilson had, and we're talking again, like Jefferson, your first growth French stuff, really expensive stuff. And he had this, had a very lovely collection of it and kept it at the White House. Now, Woodrow Wilson supported prohibition. It actually is going to be enacted while he's president, but he was one of those politicians, and there were many of them, who supported prohibition in public, but not really in their private life. In their private life, they wanted to do what they wanted to do. So the deal with prohibition is this: you can't forbid someone from drinking something that violates the First Amendment. So what prohibition actually forbids you from doing, the 18th Amendment says it is illegal to make, transport, or sell spirituous liquor. So you came home one day and there was a bottle of beer on your front table that the angels had left for you. You could completely drink it. It was completely legal. The other loophole of prohibition is, if you purchase whatever alcohol you have in your house before prohibition takes effect, you can keep totally legally. You can drink it completely legally. So if you have the wherewithal to buy a big collection of liquor or wine, you can keep it. Trouble is for Wilson. When he becomes president, he brings his wine collection into the White House and prohibition takes effect while he's president. And so as he's leaving the White House, he's got this very lovely wine collection that he knows a lot about, has spent a lot of money on, that's perfectly legal, but now he's moving and he has to transport this alcohol out of the White House. So how does he do that? Transporting alcohol is now illegal, and he's obviously the president, so there's going to be some focus on him, so they'll nab him if he tries it. And so they think, and eventually Wilson and his wife remember that presidents can sign executive orders. And suddenly the fireworks go off in their brains and they realize, okay, let's do this. Wilson at this time is pretty ill. His wife has purchased a home in Washington, D.C., about 2 miles away from the White House. And they're going to sign an executive order that on Inauguration Day, between the hours of noon and 4 p.m., it is perfectly legal to transport alcohol from the White House at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue to the 2300 block of S Street Northwest. So Wilson is able to...
Very convenient.
Very convenient. He's able to completely legally bring his liquor up Connecticut Avenue and to his new home, where he has installed one of, which it still exists today, one of the finest Prohibition-era wine cellars in all of Washington, D.C. And so he's able to transport his liquor. He drinks it without fear, all because of an executive order.
You know, it's always do as I say, not as I do, of course, right? Let me enact this law, but clearly I need to get around it.
Yeah, obviously, it's for you all, not for me. And the next guy who takes over after Wilson is the embodiment of this. Wilson doesn't want to leave his alcohol in the White House for a number of reasons, but one of them is Warren Harding is coming to town, and you just can't trust Warren Harding because he'll drink all
in general.
In general. Don't want to trust him around your young daughters, and you don't want to trust him around your liquor. Warren Harding is very interested in both. The daughter stories for another time. We'll get to it. But Harding votes for prohibition while he's a senator. He actually votes for the 18th Amendment, but has absolutely no intention of abiding by it. So he's very much one of these politicians, and he learns this lesson at the very beginning of his political career. The reason he makes his name in Ohio politics is there is a governor in Ohio named Myron Herrick who comes out against prohibition movement. And the prohibition forces, led by something called the Anti-Saloon League, mobilizes against Myron Herrick, forces him out of office, which creates a window for Warren Harding. So Warren Harding has learned very early in his political career, do not mess with the liquor interests. They want it gone, just vote for it. And so he does. He keeps, however, a very well-stocked sidebar while he's senator. And then when he moves into the White House, he is known to bring whiskey with him and will have a tipple before he tees off when he goes golfing, which he does quite frequently. He has a twice weekly poker cabinet. He has a bunch of dudes come over to smoke cigars and drink whiskey and play poker. And the games are full of all kinds of liquor that he gets from a bootlegger. So a bootlegger is going to literally bring alcohol to the White House for the President of the United States. One of the members of his cabinet actually operates an illegal liquor still while he's serving in the President's cabinet while Prohibition is happening. So Warren Harding does not give a hoot about Prohibition. He is very interested in sort of bucking the Prohibition Amendment.
We'll have to do Harding at some point before the end of this year. 2020's been tough. The people deserve Warren G. Harding.
People deserve Harding, yes. Most underratedly scandalous U.S. president, in my opinion.
That said, this is not so scandalous Harding's drinking. It's just run-of-the-mill political hypocrisy. Like, he has no problem voting for this amendment that he knows he will never abide by. And he knows that no one will hold him accountable for that.
No. He's by no means the only one either. Certainly. There are plenty of members of Congress, and they're almost entirely men in those days, who vote for the Prohibition Amendment and then demand to get liquor brought into the Capitol by a bootlegger.
Am I next?
You are, FDR.
This is why we shouldn't drink in podcasts.
Right.
I'm just like listening. I'm like, this is so interesting. Coming to the end of Prohibition, we have Franklin D. Roosevelt. Roosevelt runs essentially on the, as one of his positions, repealing this amendment and ending Prohibition in the United States. So by the time FDR is running for president, people are over it. People are ready to drink. And it's going to happen pretty quickly. 5 days after his inauguration, Congress has a special session to re-legalize beer. And then within just a matter of weeks, you have the 21st Amendment. So this is all going to happen pretty, pretty quickly. When he signs the 21st Amendment, Franklin D. Roosevelt said, "I believe this would be a good time for a beer." And then they say the country was deluged, that these barrel houses were springing up everywhere, that people were driving up and filling the rumble seats full of just like jugs and gallons of alcohol. So you get this idea from the end of Prohibition that it was kind of a free-for-all party.
Do you know, I've read somewhere once that there's speculation that the reason Roosevelt actually is able to become president is partly because he's out of politics for most of Prohibition. His bout with polio is right after Prohibition becomes legal. And so he's out of commission for most of the 20s.
And he doesn't really have to weigh in on
the issue. He's not forced to take a position that he'll later have to backtrack. By the time he gets sort of back and healthy enough,
People are over it.
It's very clear that Prohibition is a failure. And so he's able to stake the high ground without having to backtrack.
I'm not going to sing this because nobody wants that, but there was a popular folk song from the Depression, and it went, "Roosevelt was elected in time, went to the Treasury and found one dime, got back liquor and got back beer, heap better times in the next 4 years." So at this point, there was enough support for ending Prohibition that this was what the people of America overwhelmingly wanted. Now, FDR himself was not a heavy drinker, but he did love cocktail hour. This was one of his all-time most favorite parts of the day. He would make fresh batches of martinis. He always made them himself. He called cocktail hour his children's hour. This was usually 4 or 5 o'clock. He would invite members of his inner circle. So you knew you were tight with Roosevelt if you got invited to Children's Hour, because not everybody was. You had to be close to him. This was something that he once invited Churchill to come join him for his Children's Hour, that you would bring people around, you'd gather, and they would gossip. The drinks were such a prominent part of his kind of foreign policy that one official said that Roosevelt's entire plan for U.S.-Soviet relations was four martinis and let's have an agreement. That was Roosevelt's plan. Like, we're just going to sit down, we'll have four martinis, and Stalin and I are going to figure it out. He is credited, FDR. No, FDR is credited with giving Stalin his first ever martini. Stalin said, "Too cold on the stomach," which you're right. He was not a martini drinker. He, I think, wanted that vodka just straight up warm the way they drink it. But, you know, you think of Roosevelt as doing these cocktail parties and starting the party early, but Roosevelt was not a heavy drinker. He was usually two cocktails before dinner and that was it. Maybe a third cocktail with games later with cards, but he did not drink heavily. He actually lectured his children on the importance of regulation and moderation. He said, a gentleman learns his capacity and tries not to exceed it. If he must drink to excess, he does so when he has no call to be in touch with anyone else. So that's I think, kind of good advice, you know? You learn your limits and you try to stick to them.
I like that. I don't think it took, though. At least one of his kids, I think, had a problem with alcohol. So I don't really think it took. He also has, late on in his life, there's this great speech that he gives when he's running for president for the fourth time. And it's at a gridiron dinner, which is a dinner that still takes place in Washington. And there's video of this. You can look it up. And he's talking at this dinner. And everybody's had a lot, including Roosevelt, had a lot to drink. And he gives this speech. And this is the speech about his dog. And so he starts talking about how in the campaign, the Republicans are not content to attack him. They attack his wife and his sons. And now they're attacking his little dog.
His beloved Fala.
And it's this great moment. And you can tell when you watch the video footage that Roosevelt's kind of half in the bag. And
he's fired up.
Yeah, he's pretty fired up and he's pretty intoxicated. And then the applause breaks out and it's not a particularly funny line, but it's like everybody in the audience is like, oh, yeah, we're having so much fun. And they all like applaud this.
I mean, it certainly seems like from many people who are in his inner circle that he had these cocktail parties not with the intention of getting drunk and that he would try to moderate. But Secret Service, who worked with Roosevelt, some guy in one memoir wrote that they sometimes would carry him into his bedroom chanting college fight songs. So that perhaps every now and then, if he had maybe one too many martinis, it was college fight song time.
I love it.
Which we all have our little drunk habits, and that was FDR's.
Your favorite, Truman. Do you know what Truman drank?
Bourbon.
Bourbon. All day.
Bourbon. I will tell you, I talk about this in the Truman episode on his birthday, but Truman lives a long time. He lives into his 80s, and he started his day with bourbon and a brisk walk, and I think that's good life advice.
Listen, Harry was onto something.
Okay, no, I'm going to tell one more quick little Truman story. I wasn't sure if you're going to say it, but there's a story, and it might be apocryphal, but of early into his time as president, he and Bess had asked one of the White House stewards to make them an old-fashioned, and, you know, the guy makes it. And they're like, no, we don't like this. So next night, it's like, could you make us an old-fashioned? But, not as much ice and maybe real light on the sugar or whatever. It's okay. You know, he makes it. They don't like it. Third night, Bess is like, let me show you how we like our old-fashioned. And it's like bourbon. Just like bourbon in a glass. So I just think that that's they liked it straight up. But Truman was very fastidious. It was not about drinking to excess for him. It was to keep the vigor. Keep you going. I'll let you get to Kennedy. Sorry.
No. Yeah. So JFK was a big party guy. Everybody knows JFK was a big party guy. However, he was not a particularly outlandish drinker. I mean, he drank, like, certainly, but he had really hoity-toity tastes, apparently, too. He drank, this is in the 50s, while he's senator and congressman, he drank Heineken, which in those days was hard to come by. It's imported, it's pretty expensive, and so he favored really, sort of hoity-toity stuff. Highballs, Manhattans. He apparently loved daiquiris and Bloody Marys, which seemed to me to be a little bit, I don't know, not exactly what you picture for JFK, I guess. But he's not really known for being a crazy partier, at least with liquor. As one writer put it, JFK preferred women to whiskey and wine.
I believe that. Following Kennedy is kind of his polar opposite. That's Lyndon B. Johnson of Texas, who I love as a figure, as a political figure to talk about. And someday we will do an LBJ podcast episode because there's so much there. When it comes to LBJ and drinking, he is not fancy like Kennedy. He just likes to guzzle it down. And, you know, Johnson had a lot of insecurities. He had a lot of psychological things going on. And he filled a lot of that hole with drinking and smoking and vulgarity. So he drank a lot. But one thing I find remarkable, and I think it's important to note, is LBJ, early into his political career, knows that stuff gets done over drinks. You want to get anything to happen in Washington, D.C., it's going to happen over alcohol. And as much as Johnson in his personal life liked to throw down, when he was Senate Majority Leader, he had specific instructions to his staff that anytime he had guests in his office, they were to make his scotch and soda little scotch, mostly soda, and make everyone else scotch, little water, right? Or a little soda. He always had the drinks made so that he could keep the clear head and get done what he had to get done. And he would document the times that he just kept the conversation going long enough to get his, whoever he was trying to win over or convince drunk, he'd get done what he needed to get done, then he would cut loose. So to have that kind of presence of mind to be like, I'm going to get these guys drunk. I'm going to pretend that I'm in on this. Get you to, you know, connect yourself to this bill or to sign off on what I want to do politically, then I'll go party.
I love Johnson for so many reasons, and that's like one of them. Like, I love that he was that calculated about it. It's so very him in some elemental ways.
And doing it so sneakily, like having it so that the drinks were made purposefully. And he did this at the White House. He did this at state dinners, right? Making sure that whoever was there had more to drink than him until he got what he wanted. That said, when he did cut loose, he usually would cut loose on his ranch back in Texas. There's these great stories from Secret Service of Johnson just wheeling around. He had this Lincoln Continental convertible. He customized it with giant mud tires so he could go mudding in his caddy, which is hilarious to me. He would drive around. He'd have a styrofoam cup. He preferred Cutty Sark when he was relaxing on his own. And he'd literally like mud, drive. He'd drive by Secret Service, stick the styrofoam cup out of the window and just wait for somebody to refill. And then he'd continue on. And then he'd drive back by. When he saw reporters, he'd share his drink with reporters, stick it out. Like, and it was just out of this styrofoam cup. No airs, no fancy martinis. He's just drinking and driving on his ranch.
That's outstanding. I love that.
Apparently, too, he kept a portable scotch bar in whatever Secret Service vehicle was trailing him on longer road trips. So this is something for when we get back to traveling, folks. Consider a portable scotch bar to go with you.
This is gold. This is a man who thought about his drinking. He was very considerate about it. I respect that a lot.
I mean, LBJ had a plan.
Yes, always had a plan. So then we're going to move on to Nixon. And Nixon has a couple of good stories. Nixon apparently had quite the low tolerance. And one of the stories, like Woodrow Wilson, Nixon was a big wine drinker. And he, because again, like Johnson, he was a man of pretension. He comes from humble beginnings. He was deeply insecure. For evidence, see the entire Watergate scandal. And he wanted...
His whole career.
He wanted to put on airs. And so he thought the best way to do that was to learn about and really appreciate fine wines. However, he wasn't really great at sharing. What he would do is he would have dinner parties while I was in the White House, and he would take out these bottles of very fine French stuff, and he'd show it off to his guests, which, fair enough. If I could afford that stuff, I would too. We're talking thousands of dollars of bottles. We're talking Petrus and all this really rarefied stuff. And he'd show off the bottles. He'd make the big production of uncorking it, you know, and serving himself and talk about the tannins and all the wine stuff that you're supposed to know about. And then his stewards at the White House would have been previously instructed that when you're pouring the wine, Nixon gets the good stuff. And his guests, they all got poured wine from a lesser bottle. So he didn't want to waste the really expensive good stuff on his guests who would not appreciate it. He had the stewards cover up the label and pour his sort of lesser wine to his guests, figuring correctly that they would not know the difference. And that, I feel like, is the most Nixon story that has ever Nixoned ever. He also was a notorious drunk dialer.
Oh my God.
So it's one thing, like, we've all done it. Let's not lie. We've all drunk dialed.
Can I just say, do the young peoples, do Gen Z, do they drunk dial, or is it like drunk text or drunk snap?
Yeah, I think people drunk text now.
Drunk story. Yeah. I sound 1,000 years old right now.
I am 1,000 years old. Back in my day, we drunk dialed. And it's one thing when you call your ex and you drunk dial and you whine about how much you miss them. However, when you're president of the United States, drunk dialing is a whole new different thing. Nixon apparently almost started a war while intoxicated. In April of 1969, North Korea shot down one of our spy planes. Nixon proceeded to get ragingly drunk and ordered a tactical nuclear strike on North Korea in retaliation for downing our spy plane. He ordered the Joint Chiefs to, you know, pull together a plan for tactical nuclear strikes, and they would have done it because he's the commander in chief, except at the last moment, Henry Kissinger, who's National Security Advisor and Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger steps in and orders the Joint Chiefs to stand down on the order until the next morning when Nixon sobered up. So Henry Kissinger, who no one has elected anything, has just basically countermanded the commander in chief and prevented him from starting World War III.
You know what's insane is we have a rule not to talk about people who are still alive, and yet Henry Kissinger is still alive. That man is still here, and I will leave my thoughts on him at that. I have to say, not only did Nixon drunk dial, Nixon also drunk recorded, because when you listen to the Nixon tapes, that tape recorder of things he kept, he got on there, and you can listen and tell he's clearly lit.
Yep. Oh, yeah. He would just babble about all kinds of stuff while he was very intoxicated.
He falls a little before this, but Eisenhower, and it's not so much while he's president, but Eisenhower is at Camp Meade. He's stationed at Camp Meade during Prohibition between the World Wars. And while he was at Camp Meade, he was responsible for brewing the bathtub gin for the boys. And his buddy Patton, who would go on to be General Patton, was responsible for brewing the beer. So Eisenhower and Patton were in charge of the underground drinking operation at Camp Meade. He didn't drink as much in office, probably, as he'd aged. But during those Camp Meade years, he was out there making the bathtub gin.
Outstanding. I love it.
I like Ike.
That's very on brand.
And
I would imagine he drank during the Normandy campaign, Lord, too, because if there's ever a time to drink, man, that is the time.
There's also apparently a story that at some point Eisenhower got drunk at a bar and punched a hole in the wall of the bar, but I can't substantiate it or get any real details on it. So we'll have to put that out in the ether as like a thing that could have happened, maybe. And there we have it. Presidents and their drinking habits. That's pretty
yes,
fun.
Yes, there we have it. There we have it. By the way, Becca, so we've had some president, we have current president is a teetotaler. Do you know where the term teetotaler comes from?
I do not.
During the fight for prohibition, the term abstinence meant something different then than it does today. And it was not enough that you abstained from drinking. You had to be capital T totally abstinent.
Ah, so teetotaler. Interesting. I did not know that. That's a really good bit. And I do think at some point on the podcast, we're going to dig in a little more on temperance, on prohibition, on some of these prohibition stories specific to DC. So that'll be coming, I think. And it sort of weaves into some good scandals and some good other stories. But I think this was a fun, I'm just like looking out my window and it's a bajillion degrees. And like, I've been enjoying this cold beer and just talking about presidents drinking. It's been very fun. Hopefully it's been fun for our listeners as well. Hopefully you have enjoyed a drink or two during this. We encourage everybody, if you like this episode, to subscribe to the podcast and review us. We really would love your reviews. We'd love your feedback. You can also find us online, particularly at Twitter. We're at TourGuideTell. Please tweet at us. We are loving everyone who's sharing their thoughts on our episodes. And we're sharing some more information on Twitter, so our show notes and some of the background stuff. And we would love to hear some recommendations or suggestions for future episodes. So be sure to connect with us online.
Yes. You can email us at tourguidetellall@gmail.com if you want to get in touch with us that way. We are on the Facebooks at Free Tours by Foot HQ, and we love to talk to our listeners. You also, if you want to support the podcast, best way to do that is, of course, to like and subscribe and rate us on iTunes or Spotify or however you get your podcasts. But if you want to go above and beyond and become a patron, our Patreon page is tourguidetellall. Really helps keep us afloat in these COVID times when we're not out giving the tours that we normally would. So if you're interested in that, we would be super grateful. We love our patrons so very much.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for supporting and listening. We hope that when you listen to this, you are safe and that things are improving slowly but surely in the DC region. We're trying to start some phased reopening. So we hope that everyone's enjoying that, but also staying safe. And thank you guys for your continued support.
And to tease for August, We're going to talk all women's suffrage all the time in August. We're super excited. It is the 100th anniversary, y'all. 100th anniversary of women's suffrage coming at you all month.
Our motto is women's history is American history, but we are going to be digging deep on some incredible women, some that maybe you've heard of, some that you haven't, and really talking about what's so incredible about what happens in the summer of 1920, 100 years ago. So we are really looking forward to the August episodes, and we can't wait to share them with you. So thank you guys so much for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Tour Guide Tell All is brought to you by some of the fine guides at DC by Foot, one of the many cities covered by free tours by foot. And as we start to reopen cities, we are giving private tours. Please check us out at freetoursbyfoot.com. Tour Guide Tell All is Rebecca Grawl, Rebecca Fackner, Candon Arciniega, and me, Dan King.